Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Douglas presiding.
Please be seated.
Good morning. The first matter up for argument is Carlos Gutierrez for State of Nevada. Parties are present. Please be seated.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Sandra Babcock. I represent the government of Mexico as amicus in this case in support of Mr. Perez Gutierrez. I would like to introduce to the court Consul Octavio Perales, who has traveled from the consulate in Las Vegas to be present today. In the 5 minutes allotted to my argument, I will explain why this court should remand the case for an evidentiary hearing in the district court on the violation of the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations and on trial counsel's ineffectiveness for failing to reach out and utilize the services and resources that were available through the Mexican consulate at the time of trial. Nevada does not dispute that it violated Mr. Perez Gutierrez's rights to consular notification and access. In fact, Nevada pledged to provide a merits hearing on this claim in its discussions with the U.S. Department of State, a commitment that the United States proudly announced to the government of Mexico and to the 15 judges of the International Court of Justice in The Hague. Mexico was stunned to learn that Nevada had reneged its promise. But whether or not Nevada lives up to its commitment, it's clear from the record in this case that Mr. Perez Gutierrez is entitled to a hearing on this claim for three reasons. First, the procedural default of this claim is fully excused by virtue of previous post-conviction counsel's ineffective assistance. Second, the record contains ample evidence that Mr. Perez Gutierrez was prejudiced by the violation. And third, federal law fully authorizes the evidentiary hearing that we're seeking.
What about a procedural bar because of ineffective assistance of counsel? I don't think we've ever ruled on that as far as a published opinion.
Crump versus Warden, Your Honor. What we're alleging is that previous post-conviction counsel inexcusably and negligently failed to raise this claim after the Mexican consulate personally wrote a letter to Bruce Lindsay, who was previous post-conviction counsel, and asked him to present and preserve the Vienna Convention violation. He did that at a time when the first post-conviction application was still pending. The consulate reiterated that request in a second letter in 1999, but counsel failed to raise the claim. We believe that that constitutes ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, which justifies or excuses the procedural default in this case.
But if we have a rule that says ineffective assistance counsel is not a reason to set aside a procedural bar, you want this to be an exception under these facts and circumstances.
Exactly,
that you presented, Ms. Babcock. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Well, but wait, isn't the claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel itself barred? How do you overcome the procedural bar associated with that claim?
Your Honor, our argument here, and I'm addressing solely the Vienna Convention argument, is that this Vienna Convention claim, the procedural default of this claim in particular, is excused by counsel's negligence, by post-conviction counsel's negligence, in failing to raise it when it was specifically brought to its attention.
Why isn't that claim procedurally barred? The petition in this case is 2.5 years after the remitter that dismisses the first post-conviction. Why isn't the claim you're articulating itself procedurally barred?
Gary Taylor, who is counsel for Mr. Perez Gutierrez, is going to address the timeliness question. But what I want to address is why post-conviction counsel's failure to raise this claim was inexcusably negligent. And it's because the facts on the record in this case demonstrate that the consular assistance that would have been provided in this case would have made a difference. And here's why. First of all, Mr. Perez Gutierrez pleaded guilty to a capital case, as you know, in exchange for no benefit whatsoever from the state. And he did that because trial counsel advised him that jurors in Washoe County were so infected by racial animus and ethnic prejudice that he could not receive a fair trial as a Mexican national. His plea was essentially uncounseled. Trial counsel did not even bother to meet with him and to go over the plea memorandum before the plea hearing. They delegated that task to an interpreter. And speaking of interpreters, the court-appointed interpreter in this case falsified his credentials, misinterpreted critical testimony at the penalty phase hearing.
What testimony?
There were testimony. He testified during the state's presentation of its aggravating witnesses. And there are numerous examples that have been given by counsel in the habeas corpus petition and the briefs before this court. I don't have time to go into the specific examples, but I would direct the court to pages 23 to 32 of Mexico's amicus brief in this case for an explanation as to why consular assistance would have made a difference. This court, federal law does not prevent the remedy that we're seeking. In fact, it fully authorizes it. And the court indeed has an international law obligation to remand this case for a full and fair hearing. This is an obligation that all nine justices of the Supreme Court have recognized. It is an obligation that both the Bush and Obama administrations have embraced and is one that the state of Oklahoma provided before Nevada. We would encourage the court to live up to this obligation and to remand the case for an evidentiary hearing. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gary Taylor. I'm from the Federal Defender's Office. And I got less than 10 minutes to address a very, very complex case and probably the most complex area of law, in which already has the most severest consequence that the law can impose. And I want to address whatever y'all want to address. I mean, whatever questions you have. But before we get there, I wanted to tell the court that at a minimum, I believe your opinion should address four things, at least. I think your opinion should state what precautions our state will insist upon whenever a defendant who does not speak or understand English language and culture is charged with a felony offense. I think your opinion should answer the question, what do we really expect from our state habeas corpus counsel when we appoint them? I think your opinion should deal with whether or not allowing, essentially the McConnell question, whether or not we can allow the torture aggravating circumstance or the torture element of murder to satisfy an aggravating circumstance. I know the court has ruled adversely to me in Hernandez, but on the same token, I think this case is distinguished from Hernandez, and I think the court should address the distinctions. Finally, and it sounds from the questions you were asking Ms. Babcock, I think the court ought to fully address and the issue that pursuing a federal petition, only a federal writ of habeas corpus petition, does not waive state habeas corpus. I think that's an important thing. I know it's Colley versus State, but it's been so long since anybody looked at the underlying facts of Colley versus State that now it's become almost a shorthand blow-off type citation. But if you'll look at the underlying facts, you'll find that Mr. Colley pursued relief in the federal district court, in the Ninth Circuit, and in the U.S. Supreme Court, and then came back to your court.
Could you address Justice Hardesty's question of Ms. Babcock, specifically why the current claim is not itself defaulted?
The current claim is not itself defaulted based on Crop versus Warden itself. I understand that in a series of cases, this court has held that the one-year limitation applies, the 30 38726 limitation applies. However, if you'll look at the Crump opinion itself, yes, it was 2.5 years later that this was raised. In the Crump opinion, this court sanctioned 9.5 years. That's how long it had been from the remittiture till Mr. Crump's successor petition. The issue, and it goes to Colley versus State Judge, I mean, that's where we end up, is Mr. Gutierrez has a sixth grade education. He did not speak English. When this court denied him relief on his state habeas claim, he had no place to go. I don't think that any member of this court rationally or reasonably expected him to pull out all the papers in his case and pull out all your law books and write his successor habeas corpus.
Are you making a claim that he's actually innocent of the death penalty in this case that ties into the translator problems?
The actual innocence of the death penalty, I mean, you're asking, have I tied it to an aggravating circumstances such that he would not be eligible? We have argued that the torture aggravating circumstance is too broad, Your Honor, I mean, in conjunction with these other issues. But we are also making an allegation that, one, we have good cause, that the fact that our state habeas counsel was contacted by the Mexican consulate, provided anything he wanted and ignored them, and forfeited his client's Vienna Convention issue is sufficient to allow us to return to this court with that issue. And yes, it was 2.5 years, but that's when he got a lawyer. Mr. Gutierrez can't do this without a lawyer. I mean, this is reality. To get a lawyer, he has to go to court. At that time, the only manner in which our office could be appointed is if he filed a habeas petition in federal court. That was done. Our office is appointed. He gets a lawyer. Other than that, he doesn't get one.
So what you're asking us to do, counsel, is create an exception to the procedural bars for successor post-conviction petitions that is entirely separate from the jurisprudence that we apply for procedural bars with first post-conviction petitions.
I disagree, Your Honor.
Well, then tell me what the standard is that we should apply before telling me how we apply it in your case.
What you have applied in the past is that he must show good cause and prejudice if it exceeds 1 year. Good cause and prejudice has been held to be any...
But we define good cause.
...as any external impediment to filing. I think having a sixth grade education and not speaking English and being without a lawyer is an external impediment to Mr. Gutierrez's ability to appear in this court. It certainly wasn't due to anything he did. And then if good cause is not shown by those facts alone, then I do think we have a fundamental miscarriage of justice when we can allow a case in Nevada to proceed with interpreter problems such that the court-appointed interpreter was convicted and sent to prison based upon his conduct in this trial. And surely, when you have those circumstances... And
counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
What was his conduct in this trial as it affected Mr. Gutierrez specifically?
His conduct in this trial, or his conduct that he was convicted of, was his representation as to his skill level.
And so I'm asking, not as to skill level, but what did he do factually in this specific case that deprived Mr. Gutierrez? If you have specifics, please articulate them for the record today.
We have set forth, and I don't have all the answers I wished I could provide the court for this reason. We have... in our brief, a list of specific things we can identify where words were mistranslated or where disagreements arose between interpreters.
And do we have a record of that?
Yes, Your Honor, but you don't have a record of what occurred after that. When the record in this case is clear that official court interpreter intimidated the other interpreters present, and when that occurred, those disagreements stopped, and we don't know what was misinterpreted after that point. And there is no way to know because of those circumstances. You know, this court, when it dealt with, it's dealt with interpreters in another thing. You've talked about how important interpreters were in Tun, but in particular, in a case called Baltazar versus Monterosa, you went into great lengths to talk about what we require when we're going to have a document that's written in another language interpreted and presented to the jury. And you went to great lengths to say, we're going to allow in both sides, we're going to make sure there's a record. That didn't occur in this case. The same protections that you would provide to a piece of paper in Baltazar was not applied in Gutierrez. Further, I think it's important to know the plea canvas in this case was not extensive. We have a situation in this state to where our murder statute is so complicated that we are continuing to argue about premeditation, deliberate, do people understand the Caslin instruction, the Byford instruction, we go back. We're having to instruct English-speaking jurors on what that statute means. And yet we don't require a judge, through the use of an interpreter, to provide the same explanations in the same details to a foreign-speaking national. This is why I ask the court respectfully to look at it and provide some direction, because I think when they do, you will find that Mr. Gutierrez has shown he is entitled to at least a hearing, if not to relief. And I'll reserve further time for rebuttal.
Morning, Chief Justice. May it please the court, Gary Hattelstead from the Washoe County DA's office, appearing on behalf of the respondent. I'm willing to start wherever you want, but let me just begin by saying that with all due respect to Ms. Babcock, I don't know if I agreed with a single thing that she had to say in this case. The notion that a Vienna claim cannot be procedurally barred has been explicitly rejected at least two times by the United States Supreme Court. So any contention to the contrary is simply meritless. And it was defaulted in this case. We know, as counsel pointed out, Mr. Lindsay, who represented Mr. Gutierrez in his first state court habeas proceeding, received a letter from the consulate advising him there's a violation. And he didn't act on it for whatever reason. Now, that was in 1998, and the decision came down on the merits from Judge Auguste in this case about a month and a half or two later. Excuse me, that it's about 3 months later, not that it makes any difference, but the same year. So we read this letter that we see is constant contact between the consulate and Mr. Gutierrez after the imprisonment. But yet we don't see this claim being raised for at least several years, from 1998 when the remitter, or excuse me, 2000 when the remitter was issued, and then the petition in this case isn't filed until March of 2003. There's a lot of gap here. And as we all know, I think we all know, that when the state court habeas is done on the first round of state court habeas, the case goes up to federal court. Without exception, there are always new claims to be raised. Without exception, those petitions are either held in abeyance or dismissed for exhaustion. And without exception, we come back to the district court for the successive abuse of an untimely petition. And then we have to have a big argument about cause and prejudice, and if it applies actual innocence. But in this case, we have procedural bars that are not overcome, not pleaded very well, and clearly applicable under the facts of this case. Let me just point out.
But his claim is that had the translator been competent and not bullied his own translator, the penalty hearing would have been different. And
okay,
but bear with me for a moment. And that had the contact been made with the embassy, he would have had a decent interpreter.
Correct.
And that his first habeas went down with knowledge of that post-conviction counsel's knowledge that that there was a Vienna issue that was not articulated. This gentleman didn't get counsel until later. There is some traction in the argument, is there not, that he didn't understand what was going on because it was in a foreign language that was mistranslated, and he wasn't extended the Vienna Convention accommodation that he should have received. Why is that not truly a fundamental miscarriage of justice?
Well, you've got a lot going on there, believe me. First of all, the Vienna claim was made aware to Mr. Lindsay in 1998. Now, if that was ineffective assistance on his part, we have to show cause and prejudice why that claim was not raised before 2003. That's a problem here. There are three translators in this case. State had one, defense had one, and the court had one. The court had more than one. Now, the one we're talking about here is Gonzalez, and he translated on August the 8th, the second day of the penalty hearing. If I remember right, he was going to translate for two or three Spanish-speaking witnesses. One of them showed up drunk, so he didn't translate for that guy. But he testified for the others. Now, there has been some allusion to threats and intimidation. Not really sure where that comes from. It's alleged. But what is
right,
clear...
Right, but an evidentiary hearing could flush that out.
Right. But what is clear is it's in the record that there was a debate on August the 8th about the accuracy of this guy's translation. So the essential facts for the claim are right there in the record. And so the question becomes, why wasn't that claim raised earlier? Lindsay, in his litigation, did not go after Gonzalez. He went after Margarita Larkins. But he was aware that there's a translator. Pardon?
She was the defense translator.
She translated for the defense. And there's no explanation about why he could not have gone after Gonzalez when it's clear on the record that there is an issue.
When was Gonzalez convicted?
When? He was convicted on June 4th, 1996. This trial was in, I think it was in 95. Yeah, the conviction in this case is 1995. So, again, we still have a problem here about cause and prejudice, and if we want to extend it to an actual innocence claim, that exception doesn't really fit this case because now we're talking about new, reliable, credible evidence that puts a colorable doubt on the conviction. Not really the case here. That exception doesn't really fit. So what we're talking about then is, again, whether or not the translation was inaccurate, it's alleged. I would dispute that. We'd find out in a hearing if we had it. But the other fact of the matter is there's a lot of duplication. The state called a lot of witnesses that talked about the incredibly abusive nature of this kid's life. The witnesses that we're talking about here, the two, maybe three, it's duplicative of a lot of other information provided by other witnesses there's no dispute about. So, you know, if we're going to get into a harmless error or some kind of a issue there, I think, you know, maybe we have a pretty good argument on that one. But I want to talk about this other point that Mr. Taylor pointed out, and I have a feeling maybe he's not familiar enough with the chronology. But the federal petition was filed on October 13th, 2000. It was filed by Lindsay. Federal public defender was appointed, and I'm taking this from the petition filed by the defense in this case. Federal public defender was appointed on March 5th, 2001. They filed their federal habeas petition, amended in October of 2002. Now, as I pointed out, every single federal habeas petition that's filed in the first instance has new claims in it. So the thought that a new claim was not developed in this case within the time frame, I think is, the word was described to me as I was being naive. I think that's being naive. Everyone knows there's a new claim. Why go into federal court and spend a year or two or three waiting to develop facts on a case when the time clock is ticking away in state court? This makes no sense. This comes back to Mr. Taylor's questioning of the wisdom of Cawley. Just imagine what it would be like if the rule was, as suggested, there is an exception for every petitioner, death penalty or otherwise, can go into federal court for as long as it takes and then come back to state court safe in the knowledge we have cause, prejudice, or this new exception. the abandonment of Macaulay. Macaulay is a nice, streamlined, economical view of the way that the subject should be viewed. And Mr. Taylor pointed out that there's distinctions between Cawley and this case because Cawley spent a lot of time in federal court, filed a petition, had a hearing, did an appeal, or excuse me, didn't do a, I don't know if he, I can't remember if he had a hearing or not. Let's just say he did not. But he went up to the circuit court for an appeal. Maybe it was dismissed. But in any event, it took a long time for him to go through federal court. There's no guarantee that that won't happen in every instance. The whole point of the cause and prejudice and the time bar is diligence. So I suggest to you in this case that the idea that he had to file that federal habeas petition to get an appointment of counsel to find the new claims can't be caused because he had enough time to come within the time bar after appointment. As I said, August 8th, 2000 was the remitter in Gutierrez 2. Counsel was appointed March of 2001. That's only 7 months. Maybe it's just me. But you're going to be on a slippery slope if you dismantle Cawley. It's a very streamlined, easy to apply rule. One or two comments about some of the other things were mentioned in passing. Ms. Babcock pointed out that Mr. Gutierrez got no benefit for his plea. That was raised in the first habeas petition, rejected on the merits. Racial animus raised, rejected on the merits. Uncounsel plea, well, not exactly. That was raised and rejected on the merits. And then we had the court interpreter issue. There was a discussion by Mr. Taylor about the adequacy of the plea canvas. This court in Gutierrez number 2 had a 27-page order in that case. Maybe not suitable for publication because that's the nature of the business. Went through every single one of these claims raised at that time. And essentially all we have here are new refinements of those claims that have been previously raised and exhausted or decided on the merits. What becomes a question here is whether there's new cause and prejudice to revisit those issues. And as I've indicated, it's absent in this case. I would also point out that aside from I hate to use the expression, but a mere passing reference to the miscarriage of justice exception, there's no discussion of it. Ms. Babcock pointed out that there could be a miscarriage of justice because consulate could have done things. We have no idea what those things are in this case particularly, and we don't know what this investigation the consulate could have come up with would have provided. Stark contrast to what we talked about yesterday in Wilson, where Wilson had an extensive discussion of the omitted mitigating evidence. We don't have that here. We have nothing. It's all hypothetical and speculative. It piles on to Mr. Kapczynski and Mr. Leslie and their performance in this case that perhaps we could have acquired better counsel. Well, maybe. Maybe not. But there's no indication in here that that would in fact be the case. So, the court asked two questions in this case. Should McConnell bar the torture aggravator? The answer to that question is no under Hernandez. And did the lower court err in dismissing this petition as procedurally barred? And the answer to that question is no, because none of the claims are excused by the exceptions to the bar rules. Cause and prejudice are absent. A showing of actual innocence is absent. Counsel did point out that there's the Crump case. We do have to worry about the effective assistance of Lindsay, but that claim has to be filed in a timely manner. It was not. It's been years. And for the reasons I've stated, it could have been brought earlier. It just seems inconceivable to me that we can wait months, years, maybe many years, for a case to go through the federal court when we know beyond certainty, to a metaphysical certainty, it's coming back to the state court for that successive, abusive, and untimely petition. That is just a fact. And to step away from that is going to cause a great deal of mischief. And you can imagine what it would do in a capital case if that were the rule here. So, unless the court has other questions, I'm finished. Thank you.
Counsel, we have 3 seconds showing on our clock. We're going to give you 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Counsel, just briefly to respond, I would direct the court to Stewart versus Warden, situation. It is addressed in the briefs, but a situation where an attorney, or excuse me, a client specifically asked for certain appellate claims to be raised. The attorney did not. The court allowed it, the later petition. To emphasize something that was brought out, an evidentiary hearing will flesh out a lot of these issues. Do we know what would have happened if the consul had been contacted? Yes, we do. There is a declaration from the consul. He tells you what he'd do. Do we know for certain that we would have had an adequate record in this case that you can depend on? Yes, we do. That is one of the things that he assured you. Mr. Hattelstad, with respect, I like Mr. Hattelstad, but he wants a streamlined, easy-to-apply rule. So do I. It's just not the same rule. And that doesn't mean anything. It would be streamlined and easy to apply to say you don't get habeas. But that's not due process. We have to address the constitutional issues. The bottom line is Krupp versus Warden, 9.5 years, this court said you get an evidentiary hearing to check on the ineffective assistance of counsel. Gutierrez, less than 2.5 years. He's entitled to that hearing. The reality is we get up here, and I brought my dates too. And yes, it's been a while, but when that, you know, the manner in which an attorney is appointed to a capital defendant is that Mr. Lindsay had to go file a pro per petition in federal court. That's where he gets off the case. The federal court appoints an attorney. We find out some 5 months later the federal court appointed our office. That's the beginning. That's where we have to start picking up records. We have to start looking for things. We have to start our investigation. If you go from that point to when this petition was filed, it's less than 2 years. So it sounds much better depending on which date you look at. I don't see, and I haven't heard, if this court is interested in the McConnell claim, it's not procedurally barred. These claims were present before Bayrano was decided. It's been there. So if you're interested in reconsidering their non-dis decision, that claim's fully available under any definition. We respectfully pray that this honorable court reverse Mr. Gutierrez's conviction, order new trial, and the alternative, grant an evidentiary hearing.
Thank you. Thank counsel on both sides for arguments this day as they impact the administration of criminal justice in our state. With that, Madam Stand submitted.